Hello, and welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, August 26th, 2003. Today's session is entitled True Fasting for Those Obsessed by Dead Rituals. Session 2 of Encountering Disillusionment, Rest, Restoration, and Healing for a Broken World, with some helps from Isaiah 56 through 66. Presented by Luther Peterson. The session number is PEL 2003-02. Let's listen in.
Preoccupied with her radio on for and didn't get started right away, and the guy behind her started honking. You hear this one coming, huh?
Yes, okay. Sir.
You heard it before, probably.
The version, probably.
Yeah. And so then she started off slowly. She asked. She started off slowly, and by this time the guy behind her was passing her and giving her the finger. And she turned to her grandson and she asked him, what do you suppose he means by that? And her grandson replied, well, that means that Jesus is number one. And she says, oh my goodness, she says, I think I'll pass some people and let them know that Jesus is number one too.
Good grief.
But I'm not so sure, but what we give people a wrong signal sometimes too about about our theology and our believing that Jesus is number one. There may be some ways that we could get into discussions on how we do that, but in fact, what we're going to talk about today does relate to that very same thing as we talk about what our witness really does give to people as over against what we might think our intentions are. In the terms of justice, fasting, and all, this is really a session about justice. I just put the fasting relates to it, and we'll see how it ties together. When we talk about justice issues and a passion for justice, we're dealing with possible conflict in congregations, aren't we? And sometimes we're not too anxious to get into those areas of conflict. So here are some words of wisdom by which churches have often gone by so as not to have to deal with the issues that are before them. This is the dangers of change theorem here. The more a pastor works for change in a congregation, the more likely the congregation will change pastors. The I move, we adjourn axiom. One of the main causes of church meetings is church problems. Corollary, one of the main causes of church problems is church meetings. If you can't walk on water, don't rock the boat. And then the sheep pen principle. Shepherds always look before they put their foot down. And I'd just like to share a little bit of a reflection by Gerhard Frost that ties in here with this whole thing, and it's called Don't Laugh. They told me today of the chain smoker who read so much about the hazards of smoking that he finally decided to give up reading. They expected me to laugh, and I did. But then I thought, what about me? Our Lord says, love one another, love your enemies, seek justice, forgive as you have been forgiven. Something in me doesn't like that. So sometimes I read less and less. Don't laugh. Well, those are all kind of ways of getting at this whole business of the caution that we often exercise when it comes to an issue that has to do with justice that might cause conflict. Can you recall some of the diverse issues that have threatened to split the church down through the years? Just off the top of your head, just name some of the issues that have been that.
Predestination.
Okay. Or others? Think. issues that have threatened to split the church down through the years.
And have split the church.
And has split the church, yeah.
Divorce.
Divorce, okay.
Legalism, laws.
Okay.
That we set up.
Okay. Others?
Homosexuality is splitting the church right now.
Right. That's right.
Abortion.
Abortion, okay.
Women.
The role of women. Pardon?
Yeah, that was
The role of women, you better say.
Yeah.
To save your neck.
Yeah.
You have a few of us against them.
Yeah, all right. Yeah, okay. Other issues? Yeah, welcome. Come on in. Grab a Bible while you're at it. If you have the rest of you don't have, any rest of you don't have Bibles?
No.
Let's get a bunch of them out here.
Interpretation.
Yeah, do you have choice of what?
How to interpret the Bible.
How I interpret.
Oh, see, I'll do
right.
That.
Okay.
You can just set up here, someone else might
do
it.
We don't.
Yeah.
Oh, you don't?
Oh,
here's two.
Thank you.
This is not classified as a Bible study. It's a theology of 3rd Isaiah is what it is. So it really is a Bible study. But it's not classified as that only. In the village. Let me give you some of the issues down through the years. I was just amazed when I looked at a list, kind of a list of issues that in church history that have done this. In addition to the ones that you mentioned, I think euthanasia, charter schools, circumcision, charging interest, sale of indulgences, infant baptism, Sabbath observance, men and women sitting next to each other in worship, state control of the church, introduction of the pipe organ, use of the guitar in worship, Christian rock music, birth control, lodge membership, women's hairstyles, dancing, movies, conscientious objection and war, evolution, slavery, prayer in public schools, gender neutral language, use of alcoholic beverages, use of the English language in worship, new translations of the Bible, revivalism, tobacco, air conditioning in church, charismatic issues, denominational mergers, clergy garb, just to name a few. So this is, conflict is just part of the church. It's always been there, these issues. And some issues are, of course, not worth getting all excited about. And I suppose that's one thing we have to put this thing in perspective. When an issue does come along, is it worth fighting for, or is it worth dying for? Some issues are. Issues of justice maybe are much more crucial and worth really getting into than some of these others. And yet some of these other issues that aren't as critical often attract the attention and the anger of people more than you can imagine.
Like keeping the doors of the church open.
Yeah.
Or locking it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Let's take a look at Isaiah 56, verse 1. This is the first verse of 3rd Isaiah. As I mentioned yesterday, 3rd Isaiah, just by way of review, 3rd Isaiah is thought to, by theologians, to be the piece that was written after the people returned from exile to Jerusalem in about 520 B.C. And they were coming home with great expectations and great hopes. 2nd Isaiah, Isaiah 40 to 55, is just full of promises and encouragement and things that, you know, that somehow God will comfort you and all these marvelous servant songs. This is what they've been getting during the exile from their prophets. and they come back to Jerusalem and things fall to pieces. They don't work out very well. There's just all kinds of controversy and argument, and they a great difficulty. It is not. It is so disappointing. That's why I've named this entire series "Encountering Disillusionment." Some helps from Third Isaiah, and this the one we're going to look at today is on fasting and justice. Okay, somebody read that, please.
Thus says the Lord, maintain justice and do what is right. Pursue my salvation and come, and my deliverance will be revealed.
Okay. Justice and righteousness. You'll find, again, like I mentioned yesterday, those terms are used interchangeably all over the place. They're just over and over you hear these words used in the Hebrew text. Frederick Buechner, in his book Wishful Thinking, has a little article on righteousness. When I looked for the word justice, it said see righteousness. So they're the same basic thing. Okay. You haven't got it. I got to turn this way so I can. Otherwise, I can't see. You haven't got it right, says the exasperated piano teacher. Junior is holding his hands the way he's been told. His fingering is unexceptionable. He has memorized the piece perfectly. He has hit all the proper notes with deadly accuracy. But his heart's not in it, only his fingers. What he's playing is a sort of music, but nothing that will start voices singing or feet tapping. He has succeeded in boring everybody to death, including himself. Jesus said to his disciples, "Unless your righteousness exceeds that of the scribes and Pharisees, you will never enter the kingdom of heaven." The scribes and Pharisees were playing it by the book. They didn't slip up on a single do or don't, but they were getting it all wrong. Righteousness is getting it all right. If you play it the way it's supposed to be played, there shouldn't be a still foot in the house. So to get at the whole the concept of righteousness and justice, there's a lot more to it than just making the right decisions. It's a very complex kind of thing, and I think before we get done today, we'll again, like I say, have more questions than we have answers, but it's a crucial thing, concept in our Christian faith. Well, now look at Isaiah 58, 1 through 5. Okay, one of you read that, please.
Cry aloud, spare not. Lift up your voice like a trumpet. Declare to my people their transgression, to the house of Jacob their sins. Yet they seek me daily and delight to know my ways, as if they were a nation that did righteousness and did not forsake the ordinance of their God. They ask of me righteous judgments. They delight to draw near to God. Why have we fasted, and thou seest it not? Why have we humbled ourselves, and thou takest no knowledge of it? Behold, in the day of your fast, you seek your own pleasure and oppress all your workers. Behold, you fast only to quarrel and to fight and to hit with wicked fist. Fasting like yours this day will not make your voice to be heard on high. Is such the fast that I choose, a day for a man to humble himself? Is it to bow down his head like a rush and to spread sackcloth and ashes under him? Will you call this a fast, a day acceptable to the Lord?
Okay, thank you. Some of you may have a copy of Eugene Peterson's translation or paraphrase of the Bible. Any of you have that? It's a real fun paraphrase, and this is his paraphrase of Isaiah 58, 1 through 4. Shout, a full-throated shout, hold nothing back. Tell my people what's wrong with their lives. They're busy, busy, busy at worship, and they love studying about me. To all appearances, they're a nation of right-living people, law-abiding and God-honoring. They ask me, what's the right thing to do? And love having me on their side. But they also complain, Why do we fast and you don't look our way? Why do we do humble service and you don't even notice? Well, here's why. The bottom line on your fast days is profit. You fast, but at the same time you bicker and fight. You fast, but you swing a mean fist. The kind of fasting you do won't get your prayers off the ground. So it's an interesting kind of thing here that yesterday we talked about the fact that we should delight in the Sabbath and the Lord's worship and all that. Now here are some people who delight in their worship, and yet they got it all wrong. What's that all about? They just get really turned on with their liturgy and their worship and their fasting, and that they've got it all wrong.
May have more to do with appearance.
Pardon?
May have more to do with appearance.
With appearance? Okay, that's part of it. They want to get it just right. They want to impress each other.
For their own edification.
Right, and they can take a sort of an enjoyment of it. They can begin to enjoy the forms and the habits that go with these things without the meaning of it being carried out in their lives of justice. And
what's the difference between self-righteousness and God-righteousness or something?
Okay. Yeah. Okay. All right.
Maybe that is, that is the difference. Mm-hmm. We're so proud of giving our beautiful voices or our beautiful time or everything to God. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's a good...
In the fourth verse, it says that those who worship are quarrelsome. Mm-hmm. Does that ever happen in churches?
No.
Oh, no.
So that was too good. And I could think of it.
Yeah, why do you suppose that can happen? Fight with each other, swing a mean fist. Even though they're busy trying to observe all the right practices.
Because we each think we're right, righteous.
Okay, can be just a little twisty. That's the definition of evil, is that it takes something good and just twist it just a little bit, right? Yeah. Some time ago I read a story about a hold-up man who put his gun into the back of a clergyman and demanded his money. When the minister turned around to hand over his billfold, the gunman, seeing his clerical collar, quickly withdrew his gun and said, apologetically, "Oh, I'm sorry. I never take money from preachers." Hearing this, the minister relaxed and said, "Fine, that's okay. Now, here, why don't you have a cigar?" And the gunman replied, "No thanks, I don't smoke during Lent." As absurd as that is, do we as a church ever sort of do that?
Way too much.
It's possible. Well, let's look at 58, 6 through 12. Same chapter, 6 through 12. More about fasting. Go ahead, somebody.
Is not this the fast that I choose, to loose the bonds of wickedness, to undo the thongs of the yoke, to let the oppressed go free, and to break every yoke? Is it not to share your bread with the hungry, and bring the homeless poor into your house? When you see the naked, to cover him, and not to hide yourself from your own flesh? Then shall your light break forth like the dawn, and your healing shall spring up speedily. Your righteousness shall go before you. The glory of the Lord shall be your rear guard. Then you shall call, and the Lord will answer. You shall cry, and he will say, "Here I am." If you take away the yoke, take away from the midst of you the yoke, the pointing of the finger, and the speaking wickedness. If you pour yourself out for the hungry and satisfy the desire of the afflicted, then shall your light rise in the darkness, and your gloom be as the noonday. And the Lord will guide you continually and satisfy your desire with good things, and make your bones strong, and you will be like a watered garden, like a spring of water whose waters fail not. And your ancient ruins shall be rebuilt, and you shall raise up the foundations of many generations. You shall be called the repairer of the breach, the restorer of streets to dwell in.
Okay, thank you. What strikes you here in this chapter, just off the top of your head? Anything? A phrase? A thought? Don't be bashful.
Well, I'm taken by the fact that so often our churches become sort of insular and a community that serves only itself. And this reminds me that what it's saying is real righteousness has to do with truly serving outside of that.
Okay.
Reaching out. So the image that I get is of that service and that relationship to the brokenness in the world rather than an insular relationship separate from it.
Okay. All right. All right. We're in Isaiah 58 right now. 58 verses 6 through 12. Welcome. Anything else that strikes you in those verses that we just read?
Like a good map for everybody to live by.
A good map? Okay, fasting. It's all about fasting. Like I was telling them before, we build this as a session on fasting, but it's really about justice. But they're tied together. And this chapter really ties it together for us. What else strikes you in this chapter that we just read? It's a clear, radical statement of social ethics that's at the heart of Judaism and Christianity. God is not one who likes to be flattered in a more or less passive routine of worship. This God is out working the neighborhood and wants us all to be doing the same. Injustice here refers to socioeconomic practices that deny some members of the community access to resources necessary to life. We're challenged to make a decision here against self-indulgence. The shalom community. The shalom community will have the energy and the fortitude, if you look at verse 12, the energy and the fortitude and the resources to rebuild or build or do the things that are needing to be done, as well as to be doing the outreach and the serving and all of that sort of thing. This is a very powerful chapter, but now I want to just allude to chapter 59, and we won't take the time to read it out loud, but glance over chapter 59 and 1 through 8. Just look at it. Just look at it briefly and see what your impression is. What's your main thing, impression? What strikes you as you read those, look through those verses? What kind of a statement is this? What kind of literature are we looking at here? 59, 1 through 8. Especially. It's a quick glance. A little speed reading here. Okay, impression? What's it about? Yeah.
Well, it seems it's talking about, you know, when there's that inequity, that separation, that's part of why the voice of God is lost to you, because you are not in the midst of, you have, whenever there's that inequity, which is certainly significant in our own society, that in itself breeds that separation from God.
Okay. Okay. This is full of accusations and judgment, isn't it? Very harsh thing. It's like I mentioned yesterday, 3rd Isaiah has lots and lots of accusations and lots of conflict in the But in the middle of this sits this beautiful section 60 through 62, which is so nice and full of promises. But it's all surrounding it. You have the, and this is not a bad picture of the church. You've got the beautiful, beautiful times and messages, and yet you've got all this other garbage and all this other kind of thing too.
If I were a lawyer, I'd be like kind of discouraged right now.
Yeah, and of course here again, like I mentioned yesterday, the Bible is so earthy, and the pictures you see in this chapter are again a very earthy, using a lot of stuff out of nature also to get across some of the messages here of the inequity.
But now, what does he say about justice? We always consider justice and law, lawyers, and as, you know, wanting the same thing. But it doesn't say that here. We shouldn't go to the law, and we shouldn't be consulting. We shouldn't go to courts.
Interesting question. Anybody want to? Anyone want to answer that for me? And anytime we get a hard question, I ask the group.
It's fair.
What would you say to Ruth in that when she says that?
I have a nephew that's a lawyer. I'm
watching. Well, first of all, the law or justice, as we think about it, law is not, as you referred to and it's been referred to, not God's justice or righteousness. There's a difference. So that can help guide us in how we think about working things out and not necessarily going through justice, the quote, justice.
Okay. Yeah.
Not all lawyers are in favor of the cases that they're defending, or I'm just thinking of cases that the ACLU, for example, defends, and I know some of those cases, the lawyers say, well, it doesn't really matter that I agree with it or not, but it's because it's the law of the land that I'm defending it. It's for freedom of speech that I'm defending it, not because of this particular case. It might be beneficial to the Ku Klux Klan, but it has a larger purpose.
Mm. Okay. Mm-hmm. Okay.
And what does a Christian say about that?
What's the larger purpose? I'm wondering, is there a larger purpose going on within the law that individual lawyers in their particular cases don't necessarily agree with?
But is there a larger purpose than the law of the land that we need to pay attention to? Maybe that's getting at it.
Well, if we talk about Torah as being law, we're talking about a much bigger thing than just little laws, and justice and righteousness and shalom are a much bigger thing than just the legalisms of little laws or rituals or fasting practices and all that sort of thing. So you're getting at something really important there, Ruth, that this is a much bigger, the word justice has a much bigger and broader meaning here than it does in terms of just
the
legal.
Between you and God, not between you and each other.
Yeah.
Hey, what's wrong here? You're hating your brother. What are you going to do about that?
Right.
Whether he deserves it or not, there's a higher law than what I think to be just.
Okay.
Somebody kills my kid or something.
And this leads into also the whole idea that there's the whole idea of justice and how what we should be doing in terms of being just is very, very complicated. That's why I say when we get done here, I would guess and I would hope we have more questions than we have answers, because that means you'll be thinking about it and you'll be concerned about it. Here's a little story. The story is told about a rich Russian woman shortly before the Bolshevik Revolution who one evening attended a play in Moscow. She had a good cry, empathizing with the miserable, long-suffering life of the peasant vividly depicted in the drama. However, while she was enjoying her tears, outside the theater in the bitter cold of the Moscow winter night, her peasant coachman froze to death. What's the moral of that story, do you suppose? Is there anything like, isn't there anything there, moral of that story that might? You see anything there?
Oh, we can.
Go ahead.
Well, it's just what it's all been about. It's that you know, being contented and happy and righteous in your insular little world and not being connected to the greater world and the real suffering that exists outside it. It's easy to sit down and say how righteous and wonderful and prayerful you are, but if you're not making that action out into the world, you're disconnected in a way that separates you from God.
Okay. Other thoughts about that? The moral of this story? What does it say to us? Our feelings of sympathy, do you suppose there are feelings of sympathy can be sometimes a device to insulate ourselves from what's really happening. Or as this author, Wayne Muller, says in his book on Sabbath, which I was raving about yesterday, it can get us, our feelings of sympathy can get us moving so fast that we don't stop to really, really deal with questions in depth and really take the time to take a Sabbath to really rest and think about long enough what we really should be doing, so we get all screwed up and do the wrong thing anyway. And here's just a quick glance at this chapter.
Is that something like the person who said that I love children in the abstract, but yeah, not in the concrete.
Sort of like that. Now here's, he uses an example in here this little chapter is called Doing Good Badly. And this one is, this little section, an example here about, in our frenzy to make the world a better place, it's easy to presume that the romance and magic of our good intentions will protect us from doing unintended harm. For example, how many of us, touched by the heart-wrenching photos of starving children in the Sabele region of Equatorial Africa, mailed our donations to help the poor unfortunate children in the early 90s? But how many of us would be shocked to discover that our generosity had contributed to their suffering? He goes on to explain this, how they got these wells drilled and they got all kinds of water, and so they got zillions of cattle all of a sudden on the scene, and all kinds of grass growing and stuff. But they upset a delicate balance of nature, which screwed it all up, and these cattle started dying, and pretty soon these people were worse off than before, and they had a terrible famine in the land. The complexity of how we do justice is something which is just mind-boggling. And now, it shouldn't stop us from wanting to do something, but it should, like he says, let's take a Sabbath and really go and look at what's going on. Yeah.
Could that have anything to do with wanting to free the people of Iraq and then thinking we're doing a good thing, and who knows if we're actually doing a good thing?
Yeah. I would say amen. Yes.
My goodness, you're getting us into a terrible hole here when we go on these texts. We were part of a group, like the Rotary Club, who drilled about 500 wells in West Africa in the late 80s.
Oh, okay.
And I have videos of a woman carrying water, take her all day with 65 pounds of water in her head, pregnant, carrying a baby on her back and pulling a little youngster along, and that's the way she spent her day. But when we drilled that well, that woman then could enjoy life in the village and no longer had to spend her day that. And the well she had before that, or the people had before that, was a 20-foot thing. It was green at the bottom and just a hand-dug well. And I couldn't see that as anything but a humanitarian effort to help the lives of all of us.
I don't like that example.
And then when he says that the cattle, you know, that's a different issue.
Say nothing of the pure water that they have instead of the infected water of the sewer.
Yeah, what he's getting at here is that in that particular case, It was bad. Now, I don't think you would say that all well drilling. Certainly, must be a lot of great well drilling that's going on.
But
what I'm saying is, these things are so complex that if we think we can come up with a quick solution to everything, I would certainly encourage you to go and dig some more wells. You know, if that would be.
Well, I've heard those things that boreholes. You know, they don't help the problem and whatnot, but. Don't we all, as individuals, we see a problem here, we want to help our neighbor, and that's what we're encouraged to do. So we go and help him. Well, then now he should have done it himself. You shouldn't go help him. See, you can get into all kinds of things.
Yes, like that. you're that's good. You're really helping unpack this the complexity of this thing. He also uses some other examples in here. He was all gung-ho back in a number of years ago for getting people out of these institutions, the mentally ill and the all these kind of people, the children that were delinquents, get them out of the institutions and out back into the communities where they were. But he says this has caused all kinds of new problems. And he goes into how that is, and I think you know what those problems are. His main solution again, I mean his main thing that he's trying to say is, we didn't think through these things carefully enough. We should have taken a Sabbath to go and talk to these people, these parents of of these delinquents, the people who felt they couldn't take care of this member of the family who turned out to be mentally ill so that he's on the street now. We didn't really take the time to really go through this and come up with a better answer. We've got a worse problem now than we had before, he says. But I just want to raise that thing that we are into something which is not, there are no easy solutions to it at all, and so I think we've now we've got to take a look at it. My goodness, where's time going? 61, 1 through 4. We'll have to take a lot of time with this passage, but let's just look at it anyway. 61, 1 through 4. This is the basis of Walt's Luke 4 thing, of where Jesus gives his inaugural address. This is one of the basic themes of Lutheran World Federation and Holden Village for the whole year. Isaiah 61, 1 through 4. Okay, somebody just read that for us. This is what Jesus quotes in Luke 4. Don't be bashful.
The Spirit of the Lord God is upon me, because the Lord has anointed me to bring good tidings to the afflicted. He has sent me to bind up the brokenhearted, to proclaim liberty to the captives, and the opening of the prison to those who are bound, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor and the day of vengeance of our God, to comfort all who mourn, to grant to those who mourn in Zion, to give them a garland instead of ashes, the oil of gladness instead of mourning, the mantle of praise instead of a faint spirit, that they may be called oaks of righteousness, the planting of the Lord, that he may be glorified. They shall build up the ancient ruins. They shall raise up the former devastations. They shall repair the ruined cities, the devastations of many generations.
Okay, thank you. Notice that there isn't one call to action here. What's the dominant motif? What would you say?
What do you mean by motif?
Basic feeling for it, the basic theme, the basic kind of a thing that you've got going here.
Well, isn't there a call to action when it says bind up the broken heart and proclaim liberty and do all that stuff to
them? He says, well, I have been called to.
Yeah.
I have been called to. It's an affirmation of what, by the Spirit. Yes, of course it is, but the dominant motif here is praise and affirmation, and then this leads us to the desire to move by the Spirit and to do these things that are talked about here.
The question I have is, one of the things that I always felt about teachings of Christ is that he healed by helping them to see their beauty, their grace, what mm-hmm. their strength, okay. and that rather than going out and putting an arm in a patriarchal way and saying, I'll take care of you, is to say that you are a creation of God and you have the power within you to heal yourself versus okay. me doing something to you.
Okay.
And that's what this reflects to me is more that sense that we're sharing our love and the love of God with other people, which immediately brings about its own healing and grace and empowerment.
Okay.
That changes, yeah. transforms in that way versus I'm going to go out and dig your well and plant yeah. your food. And
yeah, it's affirmation again, isn't it? It's affirming people and the healing that comes through affirmation. And the whole attitude by which we go about these kinds of things is if it's an affirmation as over against if it's a condescension. That's a good thought. Very good. Thank you. Other things that strike you in this familiar passage, as it comes, he speaks by the Spirit. The Spirit of God is upon me, and of course it's sort of a little bit of a. Like when King David, when David was anointed, the Spirit of the Lord came upon him mightily from that time on. And of course, in 3rd Isaiah, you find a lot of references to the Spirit of God, as you do in Luke and Acts. This is a Spirit-filled kind of thing to do. Tony Campolo, by the way, I don't think he's real popular around here. Don't see any of his books in the library. this is one of the books I ordered, Seize the Day. Tony Campolo comes out of a conservative tradition, a very conservative Baptist tradition, which is full of the Holy Spirit. But he's very liberal and says a lot of great things about justice. and environmental justice. He's written one book on environmental justice. I can't think of the title right now, but the spirit is a crucial thing here. Yeah.
It sounds here like take care of your own relationship to God first. We should wear the mantle of praise instead of a faint spirit. I wonder if you're with me on this, God, or it should be, am I with you, God, and relating to him to be the guiding presence instead of trying okay. to have him kind of put a rubber stamp on what we do.
Okay, now let me just twist it a little bit. We've got this wonderful spirit, the spirit of affirmation. We just really want to do the right thing. This is what the prophet had here. This is what Jesus was all about when he gave his inaugural message. Jesus gave this marvelous message of affirmation of what he was going to be about to these people. How did they take it?
First, they were amazed.
Amazed at first. Okay. And then what?
Rejected him.
Tried to kill him. Again, we have some of the complexity of trying to do the right thing. This good news should make everybody happy, right? But it doesn't. Good news does not always make everybody happy. Walt's book, Good News for the Poor, is not something. This good news doesn't make everybody happy. And again, just to highlight the fact of the complexity of this whole thing, it's something. Where both the oppressed and the oppressors have real problems with this sort of thing, and as you well know, both the oppressed and oppressors are kind of in a state of paralysis in our society, which hinders us from carrying out God's commission, and each group has its own reasons for not wanting to grab hold of this good news and to do this stuff. The privileged, of course, are hesitant to carry this out because it shakes up the status quo, while the oppressed feel powerless to do anything. having grown accustomed to being given things, just being on the receiving end of things. And so you have this system of domination and subjugation is sort of self-perpetuating and makes it that much more complex as to how to deal with that. I guess I'm making it more difficult for you, and not more easy. I'm not giving you easy answers. But I hope that you go out of here today very puzzled, but thinking. Okay. A man was fishing in a river. He was suddenly started by the cry of a man drowning. And it seemed to come from downstream. Maybe you've heard this story too. He kicked off his shoes, he jumped in, and he saved the man, pulled him out. And about that same time, he heard another guy hollering, and so he jumped in and saved him. And he heard another guy hollering, and he ran in and jumped in and saved him. And he finally occurred to him that his procedure was hopeless. You better find out who was pushing these folks in. Need to get at the source of the trouble. What's the moral of the story? What's the moral of that story, do you suppose? Well, it affirms the complexity of the whole issue of trying to help people, and all that sort of thing.
Well, are you suggesting that there's a reason why people are poor, you know, and that we can eliminate the reasons for poverty and that type of thing, that would be a better strategy?
That would seem to be an answer.
And that's very difficult.
Very difficult to see. Very, as I mentioned earlier.
Even Christ himself said, the poor you have with you.
Yeah. It's very, very, very difficult. Very, very difficult. I'm just trying to say all kinds of things and make it real complicated for you.
Okay.
I think I'm succeeding because I'm beginning to sense a little more frustration all the time. This woman was stopped at the intersection, and the light turned green, but her motor killed and she couldn't get it going. Her car wouldn't move, so the guy behind her starts honking his horn. The woman gets out of her car and approaches the man. She says, "Mister, if you'll start my car, I'll blow your horn." And we need to ask that question too, I suppose. How often we blow our horn or ring our gong or clang our cymbals when we could be trying to help alleviate a situation, which causes us to make all that noise in the first place. People in trouble don't need the noise of our impatience. They need a helping hand of love. All of that sort of thing.
Kind of saying too that we shouldn't talk about good news, but we should do it.
Yeah.
And just it's living the love rather than entreating each other to do it and then going home feeling good. Well, now we're inspired, you know, and don't quite get at it.
Right. Okay. I'm running out of time for discussion questions. I'd like to take about 10 minutes, but we can't take that much. I'm going to give you each a copy of this and see if we can divide up into groups, into about three groups, about three or four in a group, something like that. Okay, pass these down. And here's why I'll tell you how I'd like to have you do it. You have 8 different things here and 8 different possible discussion questions. We're kind of putting this stuff together in a kind of a hurried way today at the end of the session. Okay, divide up into groups of, let's see, three, and four, maybe. Don't you work? Just divide up into three and three and four. How's that? Okay. Maybe this group talk about question number 1 and 3. One at least, and try to get to 3. This second group talk about number 2 and 4. If you get to both of them, and the group over there talk about 1 and 5. And the other three are something that we will just kind of think about. We'll just have to take a few minutes, about 5 minutes, all we can take today. Ordinarily, I'll take about 10 for this. About one more minute.
This is actually
better.
He's disabled. I think he's not. He's like 21. He doesn't work. He's very great. On computer a lot. And I've always said, you guys have got some good ideas. I mean, my response is often that it's still my responsibility here and now to make this as safe, my life as safe, and my life as safe as possible. I'd rather be working towards
it. Okay, let's call you back together, and like I say, usually I might take more time and also more time for feedback. And I'll try to do that tomorrow. But just by way of now that you've answered everybody's questions and everybody's got all the answers, the last three are homework. No, just kidding. Write a proverb on the topic of justice. If you were, and then draw a cartoon or a series of cartoons on this topic. If you should feel so moved to do that and want to turn it in, then we can share it with the rest of them tomorrow. I'd be glad to do that. If you were to write a story for children on this topic, what would you emphasize? I could ask you that quickly right now. Anybody? If you were to write a story for children on this topic, what would you emphasize? The whole business of justice and fasting and justice and all that sort of thing.
Behavior for parent, nothing is fair in this world.
Okay, nothing is fair. Well, it's okay. Anybody else have a thought about how would you emphasize in a children's story? You're going to write a story now for kids. And the moral of the story will be what?
Sharing.
Sharing. Okay. Think about that.
Nothing is fair in this world, so why bother? What's our topic, you know?
Well, that's the other conclusion. Nothing is fair, so why bother? Or nothing is fair, so let's work on making it fair. Yes, now here's somebody else.
Or nothing is fair, so I'll just take as much as I can.
Yeah.
That's a popular one.
Well, it's just nothing is fair, but so be realistic.
Yeah.
You work on it, but don't give them the idea that some kind of Pollyanna, you know, thing that the world is all...
I would think about relationships.
Yeah.
Well, focusing on relationship too, of what does God have to say about this? What does He want me to do in a situation? I thoroughly believe that God opens doors or brings people to your door or even makes telephone calls come. You know, there's a reason they happen to think about you, or there's a reason that person is there. Things happen. That God opens opportunities all the time, asking Him to help make us aware of what, how we can be a witness in some way.
Because
not vocally, necessarily, but just, okay, how can I help?
Yeah, well, listening, I mean, it might even be a book about listening, for the voice, listening to guidance, you know, moving from that voice.
Okay.
I mean, kind of like what you were talking about. You know?
Okay. Here's a little story on which I'd like to close, which I suppose could be a children's story. This is from Bill White's book, Stories for the Journey. Some of you are familiar with that. The teacher sat around, it's called Night and Day. The teacher sat around a blazing fire with a small number of students late at night. Their meandering conversation was broken by periods of silence when they all gazed at the stars and the moon. Following one of these periods, when no one spoke, the teacher asked a question. How can we know when the night has ended and the day has begun? Eagerly, one young man answered, "You know the night is over and the day has begun when you can look off in distance and determine which animal is your dog and which is the sheep." "Is that the right answer, teacher?" "It's a good answer," the teacher said slowly, "but it is not the answer I would give," he said. After several minutes of discussion, a second student ventured a guess on behalf of the whole group. "You know the night is over and the day has begun when light falls on the leaves and you can tell whether it is a palm tree or a fig tree." Once again, the teacher shook his head. "That was a fine answer, but it's not the answer I seek," he said gently. Immediately, the students began to argue with one another. Finally, one of them begged the teacher, "Answer your own question, teacher, for we cannot think of another response." The teacher looked intently at the eager young faces before he began to speak. When you look into the eyes of a human being and see a brother or sister, you know that it is morning. If you cannot see a sister or brother, then you know it will always be night. Thanks for coming.
Thank you.
Tomorrow we're talking about inclusiveness and how inclusive should we be. What's the balance between proper order and keeping the church in good shape and being inclusive?
I wanted to hear what you handled, how you handled the brother-in-law.